Everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. We are running slightly late, slightly north beyond our normal time today, so hopefully everyone is here. Josh, we'll introduce you in just a second, but every time we pick a time to run Manufacturing Hub, it's either too early or too late for at least like 40% or 60% of people. I get some people saying, oh, it's right when I make dinner, and other people saying, oh, it's right after lunch out on the West Coast, and we've got a bunch of Europeans that watch, and it's like almost 11 o'clock for them. So there is only imperfect times to run a live show, but hopefully we've got some viewers and some listeners here today who will enjoy the slightly later time. If that is you, please go ahead and say hi, drop it in the comments, say hi to Josh. Let us know where you're at and if 4:30 or 4:40 East Coast time is a better time for you. We at some point will do another show at 3:30 or 3:40 East Coast time. But no, if you guys are new here, welcome. If you've been here before, welcome back. This is episode 154. All February long, we are talking about doing a deep dive into consumer processed goods. This week, we're super happy to welcome Josh on. And Josh is going to go dig into co-manufacturings and co-packers and co- all of those things. That is his passion. And as soon as I found this guy on LinkedIn who co-packers were his passion, I'm like, one, I need to connect with this guy because he's, I don't know, one of one people super thrilled about this. And he has been willing to come on to talk to us. So we're happy to do that. So Josh, everyone, please welcome Josh Pelisalos to the show. Josh, thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, guys. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Josh. Before we dive into co-manufacturing, could you give us a bit of your background? How did you get into manufacturing? What was your career progression like? And ultimately, what you are doing today?
Yeah, it's funny when you look back and 14 years pass you by and you're like, wow, I've been doing this for 14 years. It's such a long time. But yeah, so I've been in supply chain 14 years. I started out in true manufacturing, in a true manufacturing setting. Not really the contract manufacturing space, but more industrial manufacturing, very rigid manufacturing. Let's leave it there. And for 6 years, I bounced between two different companies that were more along that same path of just true manufacturing, like talking CNC machines, converting steel to finished product and things like that. I eventually shifted more to the brand side of things and started working supply chain for the brand. So like a typical CPG brand. And I started operating the supply chain for some of these brands. And that's where I fell in love with contract manufacturing because it took all the things that I loved about working in the manufacturing setting. And then it exposed me to products that we all see every day, box of cereal, food bar, gum, gummies, candy, anything. And so it was so cool to be entrenched in that and watch these products come to life and visit and vet manufacturers, seeing them come to life. And then when you walk and do groceries, you could see all of these products and you're like, wow, like I know how these products are made. And it's really cool. So yeah, for the better part of 14 years, I've been entrenched in supply chain and all things manufacturing.
If I can ask you, Josh, to elaborate maybe for listeners that aren't familiar with what it means to run supply chain or be in a supply chain organization, like what kind of maybe tasks are you responsible for? What are you handling? Maybe like a few examples from maybe bigger manufacturers and then smaller ones as well would be, I think, interesting.
Yeah. I think the size of the manufacturer doesn't really play into what you handle in supply chain, because at the end of the day, no matter how simple an operation may be set up, supply chain is still pretty complex, right? Even if it's just one SKU or one widget that you're producing, it's still complex. There's still some form of raw material that needs to be converted into a finished good, and that process isn't easy. But yeah, in supply chain, I've touched the sourcing side of supply chain, where you're responsible for understanding all of the inputs that go into eventually making that output, right? So it's the raw materials, the packaging, corrugated shippers, anything and everything that is going to go into that product. Sourcing is responsible for, hey, where are we going to get this product from? Who are the suppliers that can provide this to us? Who are the manufacturers that can then take all of these components and then turn it into a finished good? I've touched the inventory management side of supply chain, so where you're really in the weeds on the data, right? Making sure that you're not running out of any materials. I've been in demand planning too, where your sole responsibility is making sure that the forecasts are accurate, making sure that essentially going back to the inventory management piece where you're not running out of inventory, but that your demand is updated frequently so that you're capturing future growth. So yeah, supply chain is just a mix of all of that, of just making sure that inventory is continually on hand, we're not stocking out on inventory. And then the second piece to that is supplier relationship management, or on the sourcing side, right? Where you're just making sure you have strong relationships with your suppliers, with your manufacturers, because eventually something's going to go wrong and you're going to need to talk to the right person on the supply side or the manufacturer side, and make sure that things don't fall through the cracks.
And it's super interesting, right? If I can make that comment, because I think having been in the engineering and the automation side, I'm the guy that comes in once the raw materials are already on the floor, right? Whether it is for the product or the packaging or sort of palletizing. And so I think in many cases, I've taken that for granted. I have some scenarios that I can talk about where I had to be sent out to a co-packer or co-manufacturer for some of the raw materials, but I wouldn't necessarily handle or understand all those components on a day-to-day basis. And I think that a lot more goes into it than what I've been at least led to believe. So maybe what are some of the challenges, right? Is it the challenge of finding suppliers? Is it the challenge of ensuring quality? Is it the challenge of making sure that it comes in on time? Can you explain to us maybe what are the common things that manufacturers struggle when it comes to their supply chain?
Yeah, I definitely think finding suppliers has always been a challenge. Like, no matter what industry I've been in, it's always more or less, there's not really a good platform to find suppliers. It's more so people within your network, and you reach out within your network and say, hey, do you know anybody that can do this? Do you know anybody that can do that? And then hopefully you have a pretty vast network and somebody knows somebody, and then you get introduced to somebody and then you start doing business with them. So that's always been a challenge. And honestly, even till today, right? Like I talk with so many brand owners that continue to have that issue of, I don't even know where to look for manufacturers. I don't even know where to look for suppliers. But outside of that, I think the biggest challenge within any supply chain is clean data. I think data is essential to running your supply chain, right? And by that, having the right levels of inventory, or having the right minimum points, having the right max points, having the right reorder points set up so that you're not buying too much inventory, or that you're not buying too little of inventory, right? Just making sure that your data is clean and always updated has always been a challenge everywhere I've been. And then when you think about manufacturers and brand owners both, they too have these challenges just as well, especially when you're a smaller manufacturer or a startup brand owner. That data isn't the easiest to get. It takes time to develop that data. And then it also takes time to like start connecting the dots on certain aspects of the data and how they relate to one another to inform your decision on, oh, maybe the next 6 months, I actually don't need 10,000 units of finished goods. I actually need 50,000 units of finished goods, because there's an increase in, we've seen a spike in our demand in the future, or we have some wholesaler coming through that's going to buy some of our inventory. And if you're not always checking the data or always referencing the data, like you can easily miss timing an order or miscalculating how much you should order.
And so again, just last question before I let Dave jump in. So I guess to understand better the data, and again, having a background in fairly large manufacturers that were P&G and Kraft Heinz, we always had SAP, which again, I think did a pretty good job at aggregating those numbers. But ultimately for a manufacturer that lives in the ERP system, and typically a lot of that is still manually entered, right? There's no sensors that you could automate your warehouse operation, but I'm assuming not a whole lot of manufacturers have that level of automation where they can just detect what the levels of goods are, right? So it needs to be fairly manual and handled by the right people.
Absolutely. And I think part of that too comes down just to the ROI, right? Like I think investing in solid ERP systems is essential to running a lean manufacturing facility. But now the problem is those tools cost money, right? And it becomes a point of contention for the manufacturers. Do I invest this money up front to make my inventory management better? Or can I get by right now and invest this money elsewhere? And that money can better be invested like in the actual production process of the finished good, improving their equipment, improving efficiencies on the production line so that their throughput is increased or capacity is increased. So I think it's always this balancing act that the manufacturer has to play. And I think for the most part, a lot of manufacturers, they get by with inventory mm-hmm. management.
Absolutely. And I've got some questions and some comments for Josh, but first I want to let the listeners know, I can't see your comments coming through, but I'm sure you guys are commenting because I see at least a couple of dozen of you guys on LinkedIn. Please feel free to go ahead and comment. If we don't see them during the show, we will come back after the show to go ahead and comment and answer questions, etc. Josh, having said that, I really liked your comment about supply chain and my experience working with a couple of smaller to mid-sized co-packers. The thing that surprised me was not necessarily how do we go find our suppliers or our sub-suppliers. It's the variance between the items that we get, right? Like we order 50,000 cans, and hopefully the cans are all the same 12-ounce cans, but we order 50,000 trays, and sometimes it's 2 millimeters up on one side, 2 millimeters down on the other side. We're not able to run them through the line because we've got to go reset everything, and it just takes a bunch of additional time. So I think that is a good point, and I want to go ahead and touch on that, but I think we're going to come back to that and variance within the supply chain. I want to talk about contract manufacturing. Can you give us kind of an overview about what contract manufacturing looks like in 2024 and maybe beyond?
Yeah, sure. I think that is a very interesting question because I think it can go many directions. And I think the prospect of artificial intelligence is always going to be there, right? And I think I think implementing artificial intelligence or some form of technology in contract manufacturing is always going to be the case. That's what manufacturing was 20 years ago, right? Like manufacturers are constantly finding ways to improve their production processes, whether that's with AI or with technology. I don't think that is what contract manufacturing looks like in 2024 and beyond, because that's always been the case, right? Improving the technologies to increase capacities or increase outputs or improve quality. I think where it gets really interesting is when we look at what other services a manufacturer can offer to a potential brand owner, right? Outside of true manufacturing, like in contract manufacturing, there's a pretty common term called turnkey, right? Turnkey solutions, mm-hmm. where a contract manufacturer can handle the sourcing of the ingredients for you. They can handle the sourcing of the packaging components for you. They can potentially even do packaging design for you. So I think it's over-indexing on turnkey solutions. Maybe it's even expanding into actual other verticals, right? For instance, research and development is a pretty hot topic amongst brand owners and contract manufacturers, because I think one of the cons that most people assign to research and development, having your contract manufacturer do R&D, is what happens with the intellectual property. Who owns Yep. the intellectual property, right? Is it the manufacturer or is it the brand owner? So mm-hmm. there's always this like back and forth, but I think there's a way where manufacturers can offer an R&D service, like as an actual service, not just as an avenue to get a customer onboarded into their production schedule, right? I think if they could offer it as a service, and whether or not that brand wants to do business with them or actually manufacture with them is beyond the point. But that's just one additional service or one value add that I see a contract manufacturer being able to implement. Outside of that, I also think it's like the back half of the supply chain. Like, now how do we get the product to the customer? Typically, mm-hmm. after the manufacturer produces the product and they pack it, they ship it to a fulfillment center, they get shipped to a 3PL. But it's like, what is the point in doing that? Like, you're adding shipping dollars Now it's going to another entity that's going to charge the brand owner to ship the product out to the final user. Why can't the manufacturer just add on another vertical to their process and have that be their 3PL or have that be the fulfillment, have that be the warehousing? Because I think that's slowly where the industry might be headed in 2024 mm-hmm. and beyond, just because I think brand owners want less complexity in their supply chain. Because if you think about it, if you're just producing one SKU, if you're a brand owner, you have one SKU in your product assortment, it's not that big of an issue, right? Like the brand mm-hmm. owner can, the brand owner can even handle the sourcing. They can handle the sourcing of the ingredients. They can handle the sourcing of the packaging components. They can do the research and development with an actual R&D lab or formulator. But now when you expand your SKUs, now you go from 1 to 10, 10 to 100, it becomes incredibly cumbersome for that brand owner to take all of that on. Like, so where do I source all of these ingredients from now? Let me rely on the contract manufacturer. And then it becomes, okay, now I need space to warehouse all of this stuff, and I need to pick, pack, and ship all of these products to the customer. And do I really want to pay a 3PL to do all of that? I just keep everything in-house at a manufacturer, and they handle the fulfillment for me. So I think that's where contract manufacturing is going to head in 2024 and beyond, is just mm-hmm. over-indexing on the additional services that a contract manufacturer can offer to the brand owner, just to reduce the complexity that is involved in getting a product from point A to point Z.
Absolutely. I will say that I have worked with brands that have more of that kind of vertical integration, as you put it, Josh. One kind of embedded in consulting operations role of a food and beverage group who had an entire warehouse of finished goods. And so when their group needed a pallet or a couple of cases shipped somewhere, that was part of what they had. And the benefit to them was, honestly, it gave them huge flexibility, right? So they knew what the orders coming in would be. And if it was 10,000 units or 100,000 units by X date, they also knew how many were in the warehouse. So sometimes they could run them early, sometimes they could run them late, because they had that flexibility as opposed to just hitting that specific date. And then I've worked with other groups who did like machine parts, who would just go hold stock. So I didn't have to go hold it. Typically I had to pay for it up front and they'd go ship it to me, or I could go pick it up whenever I needed it. But the value add, as you put that, was really nice, and it made it easier to work with them.
100%. I think that's what I seek as being on the brand side of things. That's what I seek. I seek less complexity and somebody that just makes the process extremely easy, right, for me, even if there's a premium attached to it, mm-hmm. Meaning so it'll be a little bit more expensive than just doing it with a tradition, than just producing the product with a traditional contract manufacturer that is just doing the manufacturing for me. It may be a little bit more expensive, but in the long run, like it reduces risks in your supply chain, because now your product's not moving at multiple points. And working in supply chain is like one of the pillars of working in supply chain is like de-risking your supply chain, risk mitigation, right? How do I de-risk it as much as possible? And that's one way.
I would say it's very interesting, again, because my, again, perception of co-manufacturers has always been a fairly like operational type of a business, right? It's just mm-hmm. producing widgets ABC, and it's sending them out at the cheapest price they can make them. So there's very little ways to compete against other co-manufacturers, but I think you're saying that it's changing, right? They're finding different ways to value add. And I think it makes sense, right? Because at the end of the day, and we talked a little bit about this off stream, you don't always want to start making the quote unquote widgets yourself if you don't have that expertise, nor do you want to go through that learning process of hiring people for a facility, building out the facility, making an investment that could be with a payback over decades, depending obviously on what you're making. So that, I think that's very interesting. I like those examples.
Yeah. And I think, and to that point too, what you just ended on right now, I think I've seen cases where the brand owner, they can't find the right manufacturer, right? The manufacturer mm-hmm. can't produce their product. So they end up actually investing in manufacturing equipment and doing their own manufacturing themselves. So that's, I think that can also be very interesting too. I'm starting to see a lot of smaller brands who couldn't get their product produced the way they wanted to, or just had troubles finding a contract manufacturer. They started doing their own manufacturing, and now they're offering manufacturing services to other brand owners, which I think is also mm-hmm. another, like the cherry on top, right? I love all contract manufacturers, but specifically, I love the smaller manufacturer that was a brand owner. They have their own brand, and now they're a manufacturer because they speak both sides of the relationship, right? They know what it takes to be a brand owner, and now they're learning what it's like to be a manufacturer. So I think it's very interesting. There's not that many doing that right now, but I can also see, like, beyond 2024, I can definitely see an increase in brand owners who start investing in the equipment to make their own products as well.
What is that, Josh, if I can ask you on that same topic, in a general sense, obviously, what does that maybe initial relationship look like, right? I'm assuming, let's say, to take that as an example, I can pick up the phone and ask to make me, as a trial run, a palette of, let's call it, some kind of a food, right? I worked with peanut butter in the past, so I can call that co-manufacturer and say, hey, I would like a palette of Vlad's peanut butter. I can call maybe a couple of facilities like that, get some samples. But I'm assuming after that first or initial sample that I've paid for, maybe with a premium on top, I would want to create a contract that's going to be requiring me to have some kind of a minimum, some kind of maybe expected order volume. Like, maybe can you walk us through the process of what that takes for, like, a brand owner or someone that's looking into co-manufacturing?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you reach out to whichever manufacturer you find. Typically, they want to know, do you have the formulation ready? Do you have a formula ready to go? Because that's actually another topic, right? If you don't have if you don't have a formulation just yet, then it's like, more times than not, the manufacturer will turn you away because they don't know whether or not your formulation is actually scalable, right? They need to know that they can work with the formulation. So first point being, you need to have that formulation in a place where it can be scaled, where a manufacturer can actually produce it. So then once you have that, you work with the manufacturers, you give them your formulations or formulation if it's just one. And then, yeah, you go through the pilot batch process or the sample process of, they run a small pilot batch just to validate that the formulation can work on their equipment. And then from that point on, and some instances you pay for that pilot batch upfront. In some instances, the pilot batch, you can set it up to where you pay for it as on your next PO. So it's an additional cost in your next PO, right? Eventually, you're gonna have to pay for it, though. It's not gonna be a free pilot batch. And then after you work out the manufacturing process on the pilot run, then you go to scale. You definitely do enter in. It's recommended for you to go into contract negotiations, go through a master service agreement. I highly, strongly recommend that. You protect yourself as a brand owner, the manufacturer protects themselves. Typically in that agreement, you're talking about volumes, how much volume you're going to do within a year. What I like about the contract agreements too is you can throw in volume rebates as a brand owner. So if you're on the brand side of things and you want to, there's a volume rebate of, just say, 1 million units, right? If you hit that 1 million units, you get 2% discount or 3% discount. And at that level, that's pretty significant. It's pretty significant money back. So yeah, you definitely want to have that contract negotiated. And I think spend some time on it, spend time on that contract, make sure that it's win for both sides, primarily looking at things like lead times, and make sure there's a quality agreement outlined in there too. What happens when there's defects in product, who's accountable for that?
I was going to ask you a question on that. Who handles the quality? I'm assuming, so I guess the co-manufacturer will ultimately have a quality control team in place, but you can also probably inspect once the goods get to the final destination, whether that is like your own warehouse or some kind of a distributor, but there's usually an agreement on both sides, or how does it work?
For the quality piece, yeah, you have, typically there's a spec, like there's a final spec that both sides agree to, okay, this is what a finished good looks like, right? This is what it should be. Once both sides agree on what that looks like, then there's checks and balances in place on the manufacturer side. So once the product comes off the line, they're QCing it. They're not gonna QC every single unit that comes off the line, but they will QC certain batches, right? Then they'll pass QC inspection there. on the brand side of things, if you're receiving it in a warehouse, if it's your own warehouse, then obviously you have the control to once you receive it, sign off on it and say, all right, this meets quality. This meets our spec, our signed spec that we agreed to. Now, if it's at a 3PL, you just set up those procedures in place with your 3PL to have them conduct the quality control aspect, make sure they're aware of the spec that's the approved spec, and then they sign off it on their end. And again, which is why I think going back to having the manufacturer reduce complexity in the supply chain can also add that level of confidence in, okay, now I don't have to rely on another person to do the QC spec, the QC check. Now it just all stays in-house at the manufacturer, right?
So I really like these points. I guess I want to move the conversation forward just a little bit, because I feel like we are getting into a question that I wanted to be sure that we ask, which are, what can brands do better? And I feel like Josh is dropping lots of like really important information that would fit under what can brands do better. So Josh, can you tell us what brands can do better, maybe from the beginning of when they go to find a contract manufacturer, but certainly like after you find a group that you like to work with? I'm sure that you're adding more SKUs. You are continuing to find ways to work together, to go through unknown situations or perhaps bad situations where you can't get some sort of critical component. So what can brands do better when they work with contract manufacturers?
I think that's such a great question. And I think immediately the first place that my mind goes to is expectations, like setting your expectations up so that you're not going into, again, this is even before searching for contract manufacturers or even talking to one, is just setting the expectations that, hey, it's not going to take me one day to find a contract manufacturer. I'm not just going to get on Google, find a manufacturer, call them, send them an email, and that's going to be the case, right? Allow yourself the time it takes to find manufacturers, right? It does take time. It's something that I believe strongly shouldn't be expedited, even though no matter where I've worked, it's always been expedited in trying to find contract manufacturing, because speed is the name of the game. And I completely understand that. But set your expectations up from the beginning to say, hey, you know what? It's going to take me 4 weeks to find a contract manufacturer.
Yeah, that seems from quick.
I mean, that 4 weeks, is quick. That's like arbitrary. If you ask me, it takes more than a year. It takes more than a year to find that contract manufacturer, because one thing is actually finding the contract manufacturer. Mm-hmm. The other thing is actually producing the products with them and then making sure they produce it for you 3 or 4 times. Then after that, then it's okay, I found the manufacturer that's going to make this product for me. That can easily take 1 to 2 years to feel that confident that, all right, this is the right manufacturer. Before that, you're still in that kind of, call it the dating period, right? That dating phase of, I still don't know, we haven't seen consistency in the product. But going back to that, like, just the expectation is, yeah, it's going to take me a long time to find a contract manufacturer, the one that I know that I feel confident in. That way, it eases the other conversations you're going to have with contract manufacturers, so that when you start reaching out to a contract manufacturer and they tell you that the lead time for a new product is going to be 6 to 9 months, that way you're not like, oh man, it's 6 to 9 months. I don't have 6 to 9 months. I need the product in 3 months. It's like just setting those expectations up, I think, go a long way. And then understanding, like, the manufacturer is not just there to, obviously, yes, they make the product for you. They're there to make the product for you and get it to you at the best quality, at the best cost, as quickly as possible, right? But understand what the manufacturer is doing from their end, right? Like, you're giving them a PO to, let's go back to Vlad's peanut butter, right? You're giving them a PO to make peanut butter. All on your end is a purchase order. I want 20,000 units of peanut butter. And then you let it go and then you forget about it, right? But you got to put yourself in the manufacturer's shoes. Like, what happens from the point that you send them that purchase order? Now they got to go source the ingredients for you. If you don't have the packaging, they got to make sure that they have the packaging in their warehouse. If they don't, they have to buy packaging. And just understand, like, the end-to-end process that goes into making your product, right? Not just, hey, I'm going to send you a PO. I need the PO in 12 weeks, and let that be that. I think that keeps it very transactional. the more you can understand of the manufacturer and their processes, the better you're prepared to handle any kind of issues that are going to arise in production. Because a lot of manufacturing is resolving issues. Like when products are on the line, it's just, okay, this issue happened. How do we fix it? The more you know about what happens in weeks 1 to week 4 after you place your PO, and then weeks 4 to week 8, and then week 8 to week 12, and the more granular you can get in understanding, it's going to take them 4 weeks to get the raw materials. Okay, what happens after the raw materials? Now they got to inspect the raw materials. How long does that take? And then after they get inspected, now we got to start scheduling you for production. How long does it take for us to actually get onto the production? Understand all of that, so that way you're just better prepared to continue to ask questions and to continue to get the answers that you need to make sure that you're gonna come out of that PO process, that purchase order process, with a finished good that you feel confident in. I think that is huge, right? Just truly understanding the ins and outs of how a manufacturer works. And I think the last piece to ensure success is, and this kind of goes hand in hand with understanding, but shifting from a mindset of the manufacturer works for me and transition that to a mindset of actually the manufacturer is an investor. Like they are investing in my business, right? Because when you approach a manufacturer from that work for me mindset, again, it goes back to being very transactional. What's the lowest MOQ? What's the cheapest you can get it to me? How quick can you get it to me? And it's left at that, right? And yeah, you'll find some manufacturers that will be happy to work with you, but they're probably not going to work with you for a long time. Now, if you start thinking about them as an investor and you start saying, hey, what is it that I need to, how should I pitch this contract manufacturer to actually do business with me, right? Yeah, of course I care about MOQs. Of course I care about lead times and costs, but what else can I show the contract manufacturer to make them really hungry for this business, to make them really want to partner with us and grow this product together, right? Because I don't know everything. I don't know the entire manufacturing process. The manufacturer does. So how can I use that, their knowledge, and really get them intrigued in the product? And part of that is just sharing with them your growth plans, sharing with them how you're going to achieve the X amount of dollars in revenue over the next 12 months, right? What do your plans look like? I find that really gets the manufacturer excited.
Yeah.
And you'll be way more successful in having manufacturers respond to you or take you seriously or competitively bid for your business. Mm-hmm. Doing it that way, I think has really been what's helped me like form these strong relationships with manufacturers.
That's really interesting. I've not seen it that way. For some reason, I thought you could pretty much call the manufacturer and ask them for a list of their process that you could fit your product into, right? What I mean by that is, let's say like our jarring lines would run certain sizes and you could pretty much pick between, let's call it those 12 sizes. And then the same goes for the boxes, right? Depending on the size of the jar, there's maybe like only two or three different SKUs that can be run through the case packer, and then palletizing, obviously it's a pattern, but I thought you could call in without necessarily having an idea of what you want to make and ask them what they're capable of producing and then fitting that piece of the puzzle. But I guess it's interesting the way you put it, that maybe you need to do a bit more legwork on your side to come prepared so that you could ultimately land a better price per product, right?
Absolutely. I think preparation is the name of the game. I think the more you can show the manufacturer that you know what you're talking about, I think the stronger the relationship's going to start off from the beginning. That way, the manufacturer can be more competitive on pricing, right? They'll know that, hey, if I invest our line time in this brand, it's going to go over extremely well for us. Like, we're going to grow together. The brand is going to grow exponentially. We're going to grow exponentially. We're potentially going to open up other lines. We're going to invest in more equipment for the brand and just cater to that brand. And yeah, I think stepping away from this transactional mindset and stepping into a strategic partnership mindset is the way to do it.
I was going to say, I just want everyone to know that I'm currently envisioning Vlad calling up a place and saying, my name is Vlad. I would like you guys to make me Vlad's peanut butter. And they're like, what's the recipe? And he's, I'd like you to grind some peanuts and put it in a jar. Like, I just want everyone to know during this entire time of Vlad's peanut butter, that is exactly what I've been thinking of Vlad's peanut butter. That is the secret recipe for everyone listening.
I could specify some pretty good peanut butter, but I would want them to tell me like, hey, we can, you know, I wouldn't know if they can add more chocolate than I would originally anticipate. I would want them to kind of guide me through the most delicious recipe. But
I was going to say, in my experience, I've seen it go a number of ways. And when I was looking for not necessarily like a CPG co-manufacturer, but like machine shops and other things to go build parts, I would know what I would need, right? If there were specific machines that I knew they needed to have in order to be able to go ahead and hit specific tolerances on specific parts, generally there is a list somewhere, be it on their internet, like an introductory package that has a list of machines that they're going to have. But like on the CPG side, if you need to go run your drinks or whatever through a pasteurizer in order to go and hit the numbers and be able to actually serve these things, then you know that you need a big old tunnel pasteurizer. And that would probably be a determining factor, similar to the ready-to-drink drinks. So if you guys like White Claw style drinks, all of that gets run through a centrifuge to take out basically the taste of sugar. So you would know that you would need one of those in order to be. So as a brand owner, you probably know, or you should know, if there are critical pieces of equipment that are required in order to be successful. What I have found is that a lot of times, anywhere from the kind of small number of hundreds of thousands or million dollars a year up to 50 or sometimes even $100 million a year facilities, it is hard to get these people on the phone. Like sometimes it is hard to get these people to return emails. So if you're like, hey, I'm Vlad, I'd like to go make peanut butter. No, I don't have a recipe. How much chocolate can I put in my peanut butter? There is a medium to high probability that you're just never getting a call back. But to Josh's point, if you say, hey, I'm Vlad, I make peanut butter, I'm looking to do these three things, and I'm looking to run, I don't know, a million jars in the next 6 months or a million jars in the next year, and I'm hoping to scale to 10 or 100 million jars a year in the next, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, then there's a much higher probability that they're going to take some of their time in order to call you back, because I've found that like lots of these groups don't even have salespeople. So like you're calling and you might get an operations person, or you're calling and you might get like one of the owners who has to take time away from many times running some of these physical machines or planning jobs or doing other things in order to go through the process of maybe responding. And we don't even want to, when we get to what brands can do better, Dave's top thing brands can do better is respond. But we are not quite there yet. I will go be quiet and let Josh make some comments if he has comments on the most recent things.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good thing to remember too. Contract manufacturers, most of their time is spent manufacturing and getting products out the door. I've talked with multiple manufacturers that they just don't have the capacity to sit down and sift through their emails or sift through the voicemails and get back to all of the customers that are reaching out to them about potential projects. Mm-hmm. So it becomes this point where it's like, how do I, the manufacturer, understand which customers should I follow up with? And it comes down to the customers that are way more in depth with their outreach and not just saying, hey, I need peanut butter. I need 20,000 units of peanut butter. When can you get those to me? Right. It's more so the, hey, you know what? Our first order is going to be 20,000. Over the next 6 months, we have plans to order over 100,000. If things go well within the year, we're going to do 500,000. And this is why. Like these are our plans. We're going to break out into Costco or Walmart or Target, and we got a bunch of buy-in from these big retailers, and things are looking really good for us. So just really getting into the weeds of that, sharing that with a contract manufacturer helps them on their end when they're going through their 100 emails from random brand owners, help them. Hey, who's this Vlad guy? Oh, he knows his stuff. He's talking about sale. He's talking about retail channels that he's going to get into. He's sharing with me growth plans already, and we don't even have We don't even have an NDA executed yet. So I really respect that. Let me follow up with him and understand more. So just dangle the carrot in front of the contract manufacturer and make it a juicy carrot. They'll bite.
And to that same point, Josh, and maybe as a follow-up on the brand side, what is negotiable when it comes to maybe these conversations, right? I think price is the obvious question that will come into play, but ultimately you can always talk about volume and how much you're going to grow and expectations, but what can maybe like brand owners think about when they're going into those conversations as levers that they might not, but that might not be as obvious?
One of the things that isn't as obvious, and it really wasn't as obvious to me until I just started asking about it, was minimum order quantities. And oftentimes you get your MOQs from your manufacturer. They tell you a number and you're like, okay, now I'm stuck with this MOQ. Now I have to buy 10,000 units, right? But if you just ask and say, hey, can we do 5,000? I can't afford to do 10,000 right now. Can we do 5,000? What's the cost going to look like on that? Obviously, it's going to increase your cost, right? But just ask, right? I think that was one thing that really wasn't apparent to me when I first started talking to manufacturers. And then I'm like, is your MOQ actually 10,000? Is there a reason it's 10? Understand the reasoning behind the MOQ. It could be that it's just way too cost prohibitive to run anything less than 10,000. But more times than not, you'll find that you can reduce the MOQ, pay a higher cost per unit, but hey, you get a lower MOQ.
I think one of the things, Josh, one of the things I've found is I've run into groups that have maximum order quantities for specific items. If you're running really weird, really strange stuff, and in drinks, I see it with peanut butter, but I also see it with like coconut and other items like that. If you're running really weird stuff, the equipment generally can only take so much throughput before it's all got to be ripped apart and cleaned. And so most of the time there has to be a really good reason to stop the run midway through, to rip the equipment apart, to go clean it in order to rerun it and then do the same thing again. So I've seen, depending upon how strange you get, especially in the food and beverage space, and I would imagine in most spaces, the stranger you get, maybe the smaller volume anyone wants to run of that, especially at the beginning, because it is just strange.
That is a very good point too. Like when your formulations or your ingredients are deviating from what the manufacturer is good at producing, then yeah, I think that's going to tie you into, that's when it's, we can't really afford to lower the MOQ, or to your point, maximum order quantity. I've never really heard of a maximum order quantity. That's actually pretty interesting, but I could totally see that being the case.
I could tell you stories. I just can't tell them to you while we're live on stream. That would cause issues with some NDAs that I have and some experience that I have. And it wasn't necessarily like similar to a minimum. It wasn't a hard and fast, we won't run that many. Like if a AB InBev came and the normal quantity would be, call it 50,000 units, and they're like, we want a million, I'm sure they'd go figure out a way to run the million, be it they buy more equipment or whatever they need to do in order to make that work. But it is just more time and labor intensive. And I find, depending upon the co-manufacturer, they are maybe not necessarily willing to go burn out everyone on their entire staff for this run and not make a bunch of additional money. So sometimes it just becomes more expensive. I think that those are some good points. I guess I want to make sure we ask the question. And again, I think we're hitting that topic. Can we come up with a list of what brands can do better?
Yeah. Did we talk about brands already, or do you want to talk
I feel like we talked a bit about brands. I feel like we also have talked a bit about co-mans. Would you like to talk about what co-manufacturers can do better? Or I want to make sure that we kind of recap for our listeners as to what brands can do better. Let me take a step back, Josh. I feel like we've talked a lot about what different people can do better. What are groups doing good right now? And then we'll go talk about what people can do better.
Sure. So I think what co-mans are doing, honestly, both sides. Mm-hmm. Let's remove co-mans and let's remove brands. Let's just say groups. I think what we're doing good right now is, I think we're actively trying to grow stronger partnerships. I think we're starting to realize that our relationships aren't adversarial. Like, we're not enemies. We're not pitted against each other. Like, we're actually, we're strategic partners. And I think we're doing a better job now than we were 10 years ago, where it was completely transactional, right? Like, now the talks of like, how do we grow strategically together? We're starting to have those conversations more and more now. So I think that's one thing that both sides are starting to gravitate towards more and understand, and understand the why behind why that's so important, right? So I definitely think that's one area where we're doing good.
Good. No, I would agree. I would agree with that. I think that everyone is looking at how we can do better. And I think that, at least in the co-manufacturing space, things have probably gotten difficult. And I think that we've probably seen lots of those smaller groups fail, but we've also seen a next generation of new money, be it venture capital or private equity or other, come in and say, hey, I think there's the opportunity, especially in the mid-size market. So most of the large co-man manufacturing space has generally been eaten up, right? There are a bunch of good places who are good. If you're a huge brand, you're probably going to go with one of those. The kind of small to medium space is where I think that there is a bunch of opportunity, but medium is still up to $100 or $200 or $300 million a year. So there is lots of opportunity. And so it's interesting to see the new blood come in and look at it differently than the previous groups have looked. Vlad, do you want to give everyone an update on how many jars of peanut butter you've sold so far during the show?
Looks like we're at 100, but hopefully some incentives. Look, we will look into it. Incentives. There's a, I will ship a pallet to automate with a manufacturing hub pallet of jars. Don't hold us accountable, but
don't hold us accountable. That could be the motto of this show. Don't hold us accountable. Vlad's peanut butter. I think it should just be, that could be the Soulless PLC giveaway, Vlad. You sign up for, you sign up for Soulless PLC for a year or 2 years and you get a jar of Vlad's peanut butter.
We'll think about it.
Josh, let's jump back to co-mans. What can co-manufacturers do better? We've left it at the continue the partnerships, continue the relationships. I already said my number one thing I think they can do better is find a better way to respond and have better communication. That is my top pet peeve when it comes to some of these smaller groups in general. But with all of your experience, with all the groups you're talking to, how about you?
Yeah, and I think you bringing up the point on the size of the contract manufacturer, I also think this is really what separates the ones that are going to try to do better from the ones that are just going to do business the way they do business now, right? The bigger manufacturers, this does not apply to them. I don't think they really care about that. They're set in stone with who their customers are. It's like the big manufacturers are working with the big brands, right? And that's fine. But more so for the smaller manufacturers, I think what they can do better, be flexible. I think flexibility is huge. I was talking to a manufacturer the other day who, and going back to this point of value-added services too, right? I was talking to this manufacturer the other day who one of his customers was shipping their product out to a 3PL. He's like, hey, can you arrange the shipping for me? Can you ship it to my 3PL? So they had a conversation. He eventually found out how much he quoted him out on what the freight was going to cost to go to his 3PL. Yep. He says, it's pretty expensive to ship to your 3PL. And then he's, can I ask you what your 3PL is charging you to fulfill your orders? So he gave him a number. He's like, what if I were to do it for you? Like, what price would you want to be at? He didn't say, oh, I'll do it for you for half of that. He just said, what cost would you want to see out of fulfillment? He gave him a number and he's like, all right, I'll do that for you. So literally right there on the phone, like on a whim, he was just like, hey, you know what? I noticed that you guys are paying a lot of money for shipping and 3PL.
Yeah,
I can do this for you. What's that number for you? He gave him that number. And then he's like, all right, let's get it done. So now he's doing fulfillment for his customer just like that. And he's saving his customer a good amount of change. So it's things like that, little things like that, where just be flexible, right? There's pain points throughout the entire process, throughout the journey of a product from inception to when it gets to the hands of your customers. Find those pain points throughout that journey and try to address those pain points outside of just manufacturing. So I think that's one definite point where co-mans can do better, just be a little bit more flexible And I think the last point would be online and be present, be where your customers are. Like, it's so hard to find good content on contract manufacturing or sales reps or project managers from contract manufacturers, right? Like, they're not present online. And I think that's so weird to me, because if you look at all the brand owners out there, the brand owners, they're all over TikTok. They're all over all these social media platforms, LinkedIn, Twitter. Mm-hmm. They're everywhere. And the amount of manufacturers, like, I wish somebody could pull the data, because I would be so interested to see the ratio of manufacturers that are active on social media compared to brand owners that are active on social media. I'm sure that ratio is, I'm pretty sure it's very
100 to 1, maybe.
Exactly.
I don't know. That might even be low. As I told you, Josh, especially maybe working with brand owners to showcase some of this product getting made, the actual getting made part of some of this product is so clippable, is so publishable to social media in these short form formats. I feel like if brands could come to an agreement to allow their stuff to be posted, I think it would be hugely beneficial to everyone, because like, people want to know where and how Vlad's peanut butter gets made, because they might be like me and they're worried about, oh, he's making it in the garage that he has literally no other use for. By hand.
Highly proprietary process, Dave.
Yeah.
Highly proprietary process.
Vlad's got two Vitamix blenders, and he's got like a bunch of Planters peanuts or whatever they sell at the Canadian Costco, Vlad. He's just dumping them in container by container. And then we see like a bunch of the squeezed chocolate, and he's like double handing the squeezed chocolate one into each Vitamix. That's how I'm personally envisioning Vlad's peanut butter. getting made, but again,
tripping over the stacks of jars that are falling over and
absolutely like crawling through the middle of it. 100%. So most people don't manufacture things like that. And so I 100% agree, Josh, if brands could go and showcase how their things are being made, if manufacturers could go showcase how things are being made, I've been on enough of the co-man floors. I know people are taking videos of the stuff. As to where and how it gets shared and if it gets posted on public accounts are completely different. But I know people are taking videos of the really cool stuff, of the machines moving fast, of the labeling, of the fillers and all of this. I 100% agree that brands need to, and commands need to, find ways to go share what they're building, because it's a very easy way to build a following.
I couldn't agree with that anymore. Like, well, whenever I'm walking the floor of a co-man's facility, like, I just love seeing that process, right? I love seeing things being made. Going back to something that you said, if brands can align with the co-mans to allow these videos to be posted, yeah. I just want to go on record to say, I think that is so, like, we need to step away from that being taboo, right? We need to step away from, the fact that, or the thought that my manufacturer is proprietary to me. Your manufacturer is producing hundreds, if not thousands, of products for other brand owners, right? Like, your manufacturer is not proprietary. I think transparency is huge, right? And I think it's only going to continue to grow, right? I've seen brand owners become more open to the idea of sharing who their manufacturer is. I think that can actually go a long way too in developing a stronger relationship with your manufacturer. So there's this manufacturer called Best Bev, right? And if you say, hey, Best Bev, I'll let you guys shoot some social media content of my brand being made. Yeah. That would be so huge for that beverage manufacturer. Totally. They'll like you 100 times more, right? Because now they're being able to get the content out there. They're being able to get that marketing, that content marketing out there, right? To bring more potential customers in. Because if you think about it from the contract manufacturer's perspective, marketing really doesn't exist for them, right? A lot of it is word of mouth in terms of trying to get new customers. So that would just be a huge win.
How do you, and maybe playing devil's advocate a little bit on that point, right? Because I think ultimately the strongest brands will typically stronghold the more stringent contracts, because ultimately you don't want, let's say if you know that on the same production line, you're making this high premium product as this, let's call it no name or much cheaper product, then I can tell you that's often the case. It becomes then very difficult to protect yourself against someone, let's call it, exposing that. So I think that's why maybe those brands put those guardrails in place where We don't want this to be known. We don't want any like video to be shared. And also on the previous conversation around quality, it exposes the contract manufacturer to some extent, right? There's probably a process where the brand can also double check the video before it gets released to the public, but there is still maybe a potential of someone seeing that video and saying, oh, there's a bit of rust underneath that railing or that guard, and then reports that to the proper authorities. And it could have been probably like brushed off for another couple of months before it's fixed. But there's still that risk maybe that I could see of publishing content. Curious what both of you guys maybe.
I appreciate Vlad being the engineer here. I appreciate Vlad playing his role in being the engineer here.
I'm maybe the lawyer here, but maybe the interesting.
No, Vlad, we have not convinced you to go to law school. I am going to read a comment from Glenn. I'm seeing a couple of comments on LinkedIn. Glenn talking about how manufacturers definitely need to open up the gates a bit more. Shocking how many old school websites there are in vacant social accounts. Google Plus, anyone, or G Plus, which is maybe the rebrand of Google Plus. It's a focus of his, but older business owners don't see the value even on a B2B level. I think that's a really good point. And my comment to Glenn was maybe half of the small to medium manufacturers and commands and other places I go and visit, there are no signs at the front. I don't know if I'm showing up to the correct place, maybe before I get to the front door, or maybe sometimes after I'm in the front door. I'm pretty sure this is the place. This is where Google tells me the address is, but I'm not 100% sure because I don't know who you guys are. They almost make it difficult. That they are almost actively hiding, it seems.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's manufacturing can be an industry that's stuck in old times, right? I've reviewed hundreds of contract manufacturers' websites, and yeah, like a lot of them look old. There are some that are nice and fresh with decent information, but yeah, I think contract manufacturing specifically needs to do a better job of stepping into the 21st century. And that's one of the things that I'm always talking to contract manufacturers about. So Glenn, it's not just you. It's definitely, it's all of us. I think we can all agree that is much needed.
Absolutely.
I think there's going to be a lot of wins even on that side, right? Let's call it digital transformation or like better apps or better, let's call it customer apps. And I think I'm going to tell that story at SPS, right, Dave, when we did our presentation. But in short, there's a manufacturer that has this portal where the customers can automatically submit essentially their recipe and their packaging, like labeling, and they can get a response, again, automatically based on the control system and the ERP system when their batch is going to be produced, right? And without calling someone, without sending spreadsheets or data, they can get an estimate through the portal, which is fully automated. So I think there's going to be more and more of those digital solutions. And it's a bit more complex than what I'm describing in a few seconds, but I think there's going to be more and more value add on that side for manufacturers.
Absolutely. Agreed. So Josh, I know you're working on some solutions, especially for the most recent pain points that we're talking about, how so many of these people are ridiculously hard to find. So can you tell our audience what co-manufactured is and what your goals are around that, please?
Yeah, sure. So co-manufactured on a surface level is a B2B directory, right? So I'm a brand owner. I'm trying to find a manufacturer that can make a protein bar. I jump on co-manufactured. I type in protein bar. It spits you out a list of manufacturers that can do protein bars. This is not a novel concept. It's nothing new. There's business directories out there. The value prop from my end is I'm curating a lot of information on these manufacturers that are on the directory that I find useful. Taking my experience in supply chain, taking my experience in trying to find the right manufacturer and what information I look for. And then I share that on the directory, right? So somebody can go to the directory and find all useful information, not just fluff, not just information that you're going to see on the contract manufacturer's website. And as we just said, like the websites are not set up the most user-friendly. You have to click 10, 12, 15 times to find the information that you actually need. So the premise behind the directory is that it's going to make that a lot more seamless for the brand owner to find the information that they seek out of a contract manufacturer. And again, that's surface level. Really, what isn't being advertised right now, and these are just conversations that I'm having with manufacturers, is to what co-manufacture truly is going to be for the manufacturing side of things. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a platform that helps the manufacturer develop that online presence, right? Like I just said, manufacturers can be online a lot better. So how do I plan on doing that for them? Via newsletters, via dedicated blog posts, LinkedIn posts, video content, interviewing the manufacturers, posting these interviews on places like TikTok and YouTube. Eventually, co-manufacturer is going to get to that point to where a point where social media can almost be used as the directory to find information that a brand owner needs on contract manufacturers. And then in turn, drive people to these contract manufacturers, drive potential customers to these contract manufacturers. So that's the plan that's what co-manufactured is.
Absolutely. I love it. I love the concept. I love the fact that you're looking at kind of newer technology and newer all of these things in order to go ahead and get commands in a place that people actually watch them. And I imagine that it would help brand owners go and find known good places. And I still think 4 weeks might be very aggressive in order to find anyone to go build anything. But yes. I think it can certainly significantly reduce that and have some kind of known quantities, known everything for that. Josh, this has been awesome. I guess before we go and ask you the questions that we ask everyone to the end, I want to have the call to action. If you guys are listening, go make sure that you're following Josh. I know Josh is on LinkedIn. If he's got other socials that he talks about co-manufactured stuff, we'll go ahead and drop those below. Vlad has dropped the co-manufactured website into the comments. And again, go ahead and follow him. Josh asks really good questions on LinkedIn and has really good insight that I know I appreciate. And if I appreciate it, I'd imagine folks who appreciate this conversation would absolutely also appreciate it. Having said that, Josh, we want to go ask you to predict the future. It is one of my most favorite questions that I get to ask because we've got answers from mild to wild for it. So, Josh, what do you think the future of co-manufacturing or contract manufacturing looks like?
Yeah, so I love that question. I alluded to it earlier too when we were talking about what contract manufacturing looks like in 2024 and beyond. But I will add this. Just know that Gen Z is coming. Gen Z is starting to pump out products within CPG, right? And why is that important? Why is that significant? Well, I have family members that are Gen Z. Gen Z gets a lot of slack on the internet for being lazy. Right. And I don't really see them as being lazy. I just see them as trying to find quicker paths to success, right? Which I think if we all could do that, I think we would. So Gen Z is coming in CPG. They're going to start making products. And what they're going to do to contract manufacturing, I think they're going to be the ones to flip this archaic or antiquated industry into more of a industry that it doesn't take as long to process the goods, right? Or if something doesn't make sense to them, why am I gonna source the ingredients, have the middleman, the manufacturer, produce them, and then have another entity ship the products. I'm just gonna do this either all myself. So they're either gonna start investing in equipment for themselves and start manufacturing their own products, or they're going to start working with manufacturers that can fulfill all of their needs. So I really do think that Gen Z and younger generations, as they start branching out into the wonderful, chaotic world of CPG, I think they are going to help drive efficiencies even further in contract manufacturing. They're going to help contract manufacturing step into this age of being flexible, less rigidity in their relationships, more of a partnership. I really think that's going to be the future.
Absolutely. I love that. And I want to add, because I didn't say it before, Freight is really expensive. If you guys aren't brand owners who have an idea of what freight looks like, man, freight is really expensive. I also don't want to pay to go move things around. Glenn is in the comments saying that the world needs it. Co-manufactured Josh. He works to build bridges from small brands and startups, taking an idea into reality. He says, cool chat, gentlemen. Thank you very much for that. Thanks for joining us so far today. Glenn, Josh, next question. I want to go ask you for some career advice. And maybe I want to go ask you for some career advice talking off of that Gen Z comment, right? So maybe someone is younger, maybe they're Gen Z, maybe they're either coming into the workplace or they've been in the workplace and they want to go start brands. What is the best career advice you can go ahead and give them?
I think there's a lot of noise out there right now, right? When it comes to careers and where you should be at certain inflection points or certain ages in your life. I think there's a lot of unfair pressure that's put onto Gen Z. And so with that, I'll say just be patient. Okay. Patience is often overlooked especially now, in this era of where all of this information is at the disposal of your hands, right? This mm-hmm. patience is often overlooked. Somebody who's 25 years old should be making $250,000 a year. And mm-hmm. that's just not the case. That's not reality. I think just practice patience and get your feet wet in different things, right? Like just go out there and find things that you like to do and try to put that to a career. Now that doesn't work out all the time. I think sometimes we all end up working odd jobs that we don't really like, but even in the jobs that we don't like, there can be some aspects of the job that we do actually like. And then if you can find that, then try to then find another job where it takes those aspects that you liked of the job you didn't like working and then just explodes them for you, right? It makes them like, now that's the core of your job. So it's just continuing, just get your feet wet in things, be patient. Things don't happen overnight. I think it's easier said than done when you see the difference of that on social media all the time, but that's not the actual reality. Like we have to remember that social media isn't reality. And I think that would be my advice.
Absolutely. I think that is great advice. I feel like especially the social media is not reality. It's probably good advice for anyone who spends too much time on the internet. And honestly, if people are watching us live, they very probably spend too much time on the internet with us, Josh. So thank you for that. Next, I'd like to ask you for a book recommendation, please. I know you're a reader. So what are you reading?
Yeah, very interesting. There's a book that I just stumbled upon 2 weeks ago. It's called A Million Dollar Weekend by this author named Noah Kagan. He just released it too. And I just found out about this guy like 2 weeks ago. And I was like, oh, wow, he wrote this book. I don't really read books about entrepreneurship or starting businesses. But this book really caught my eye just because it's very practical. It's very practical in how somebody can take the right steps to try to build something for themselves. And I also like what I like about this book is it forces the reader to start asking questions, and tying this back to contract manufacturing, I really think that's what contract manufacturing, the relationship between contract manufacturers and brands is, right? It's just asking questions, asking the right questions, keep asking until you're satisfied with the answer, right? So it's a great book. It's good, very practical business advice on how you can become an independent business owner, but it also just teaches you real world skills on just things like asking questions and asking for things you want. You're never going to get anything if you don't ask for it, right? And same as applied to the relationship between a brand owner and a contract manufacturer. You're not going to get that discount if you don't ask for it. You're not going to get your product prioritized if you don't ask for it. Just ask.
Absolutely. I think that's good. Vlad, that by just knit title sounds like something that you would have read. Have you read Million Dollar Weekend yet, or is that your weekend plans?
It just came out. I actually heard about it from, he did an interview with My First Million.
Yes.
I don't know if you listened to the podcast.
He did. Yep.
Exactly. So I heard about it. Then they had sent out a newsletter where you could get digital version of the book. I think it was like 200 copies that they gave away, and that was gone within 10 minutes. Wow. I purchased it. I've not read it yet, but it is on my list.
Okay. Yep. No, good very book. Good. That's awesome. Thank you, Josh. And then last, how can our listeners help you? Who are you looking to connect with? Who should reach out?
Yeah, so I would say to the listeners, if you are a manufacturer yourself or if any contract manufacturers, send them my way. I'm in this moment where I'm connecting with contract manufacturers on a daily basis, trying to help them develop their online presence, right? Mm-hmm. So who should reach out? I would say brand owners, if you're in the CPG space and you need some tips on dealing with contract manufacturing, please definitely feel free to reach out and connect. And then definitely if you're a manufacturer and you want to get onboarded to the co-manufactured platform or you need help connecting with brand owners, definitely reach out to me.
Awesome. Josh, thank you so much. Just based upon how well the retention has been, it has been an awesome show. This is absolutely one of those that we could probably talk for 7 or 8 hours about co-manufacturing. So we will certainly have to have you come back. And hopefully at that point, you can give us a good update as to how co-manufactured is doing. So if you guys are still listening, make sure you're following Josh and co-manufactured. If you guys haven't been hanging out with Vlad and I before, make sure you're following Vlad and myself and the Manufacturing Hub. This month long, we're talking all about CPG. We're doing an industry deep dive. Next week, we're talking about sustainability. If you're watching on YouTube or you're listening in podcast form in your earbuds, please rate us 5 stars and give us a like and do the follow and all of those other things. When we remember to post podcasts, you guys continue to listen more and more, which is pretty awesome. Until next week, we will see everyone soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all.